This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, in a well-orchestrated protest to stop mountaintop removal mining, hundreds of activists finished a five-day, 50-mile march this month from Marmette to Blair Mountain, West Virginia.
Blair Mountain was important back in 1921, the site of amazing union organizing, and it's important today as major efforts are made to stop mountaintop removal.
A recent report issued by a group of international lawyers and academics who recently visited Tunisia warns that the U.S. and other Western governments must respect Tunisian sovereignty and not interfere in that country's path to democracy.
Is it all quiet in Tunisia after the Arab Spring, or is there an ongoing effort to make it into a real democracy?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, Heidi, there's been a lot of ink spread on Obama overstepping legal authority with the war in Libya. And Michael, you've litigated this question on the War Powers Act. What's your take on it?
We should first say that as hosts, we're against this war to begin with, apart from the legality, that this is just, you know, another U.S. imperialist war in the Middle East. I mean, whatever we think about that. But it's, in addition, what's come out lately is that it's flatly illegal and the administration is fighting an illegal war. I wrote an op-ed on this way back at the end of March that this was an unconstitutional war because he was attacking another country. And under the Constitution, you have to get the consent of Congress. He didn't. Since then, of course, the War Powers Resolution has clicked in. That's the resolution that was passed in the wake of the Vietnam War, and it was passed for a particular reason. Congress was afraid the presidents would continue to go to war without their consent, and so they built an automatic trigger into the War Powers Resolution saying that 60 days after the president initiated a war, for whatever reason, whatever basis, if it didn't have explicit congressional consent, the troops had to automatically be withdrawn. I say that again, automatically be withdrawn within 30 days after the 60-day time clock expired. So that's 90 days. There shouldn't be any attack on Libya going on that the United States is involved in at all, not involved in coordination, not involved in helping with the radar, not involved in helping send its own missiles in, which it's still doing, not involved in bombing, which it's still doing. So the 90 days are over. The war had started over 90 days ago. And there's now been a big debate in the administration with Obama saying, I'm not violating the War Powers Resolution. There's no hostilities. We haven't entered into hostilities. I mean, it doesn't pass the straight face test. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's a total lie. And what's sad about it is, of course, is that he got advice from the administration official lawyers at the Office of Legal Counsel.
And the Pentagon.
And the Pentagon, which the OLC actually is authoritative on the law with the president. Yes, he can override it, but it's authoritative, very rarely overridden. And then he went to some other people at the State Department and elsewhere, including Harold Koh, who I used to work with very closely, and they gave him the opposite opinion. They said, oh, no, there's no violation of the War Powers Resolution here. And Obama, to the American public with a straight face, has the nerve to say, we're not violating the War Powers Resolution. So now you see them scrambling around in Congress. You know, Kucinich, Democrat, and some Republicans saying, let's cut off all the funding for this war. They never actually funded the war. That's another interesting point. Obama took the money from some raw Defense Department budget. He didn't even use specific funding for the war.
That's utterly unconstitutional.
Completely.
The Constitution is supposed to have the power of the purse, and since war is so important, they're supposed to fund them or not fund them.
Right, and I was asked this morning about how do you compare Obama and Bush on the war? Well, whatever you thought of the resolutions authorizing the war in Afghanistan or the war in Iraq, there was at least resolutions.
Yeah.
I mean, there isn't one for Libya. And now you see the great scene now is to see Kerry, our former presidential candidate, who, as you recall, when he ran for president, saluted the Democratic convention saying, reporting for duty, you know, to show that even though he was against the Vietnam War after the fact, that he was still a fighter. Well, he proved he's still a fighter. He's now joined by McCain at the hip to say, well, now let's pass a resolution authorizing the war. So here you go. The president does an unconstitutional war. He violates the War Powers Resolution. And then, of course, exactly what the problem was in Vietnam. You're sitting with a war going on. congressmen are saying, well, we can't abandon our troops in the field. We can't abandon our troops in the air. Our credibility is at stake if we abandon NATO. The same BS we'll hear forever. So underneath it, and it's the only analysis that counts, is this is one of a half a dozen imperial wars the U.S. is fighting. And as someone once said to me, if you only have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And the U.S., the world looks like a bunch of nails that it can just hit around when it gets into a problem.
Yeah, I think the other point is that whether it's Bush or whether it's Obama, whether it's a Republican, whether it's a Democrat, there are certain necessities of empire that these guys follow regardless of what party they're in or what promises they make when they're running for office.
I think that's right. I mean, it's you always tell us about how there's two capitalist parties.
One party with two wings.
Right. So this is, you know, we have one war party. Really, the question is, are there even two wings? All this brings me to this guy, Juan Cole, who, you know, who politically I've just never understood as someone who would be on the same page as me. And all of a sudden, you know, during the Bush years, apparently there was an attempt to get background information on Juan Cole. He's a critic and a blogger and a professor because he was apparently critical of the Iraq war. And the Bush administration wanted to undercut him. And he's been getting a lot of press lately. It was front page of the Times because a CIA agent came out and said, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't look up his background or his family or anything. And he's been called a war critic. What a series of BS about Juan Cole. First, he supported the Libya war. Let's start from there.
Still does.
Still doesn't. Today, I heard him only say, the war was fought. We're not fighting it right. Here's 10 reasons it should be fought differently or some number of reasons. So he still supports the Libya war. And then the claim that he was against the Iraq war is remarkable. Because here's the quote that he said on the eve of the Iraq war, and it's just worth reading to see a guy who is, what's the way to say it? What's silly putty? You push it down and it pushes out the other way? Well, whatever image you want to use. Here it is. My mind and heart are like those of so many Americans focused on the Gulf and Iraq tonight. I'm thinking about those brave young men and women in the U.S. and British armed forces whose lives are on the line and send them my warm support. And I'm thinking about all the innocent Iraqis in the line of fire who fear what awaits them. I remain convinced that for all the concerns one might have about the aftermath, the removal of Saddam Hussein and the murderous Ba'ath regime from power will be worth the sacrifices that are about to be made on all sides. The rest of us have a responsibility to work to see the lives lost or redeemed by the building of a democratic and independent Iraq in the coming years. So just this is the key line. Convinced that for all the concerns he has, that it's worth it, the war. So this is so-called war critic Juan Cole.
Well, this is a rationalizer of war, and we're going to hear a lot about how people rationalized the first great slaughter of the 20th century, the First World War, when we talk with Adam Hochschild about his book, To End All Wars.
Before we go there, however, we're going to hear a little bit about a lawsuit that was just filed last week by the Center for Constitutional Rights and the Sugar Law Center in Detroit, Michigan. Michael, a couple of dozen residents of Michigan filed this lawsuit against top officials of the state. This goes back to the segment we did on the new law that broadly expands the powers of emergency managers in some of the most financially troubled cities.
Well, this really goes back to Michigan, the Sugar Law Center, which is a labor law center that came out of the National Lawyers Guild, and to a number of unions in Michigan. The center's role was really, we had a lawyer on it and supported it, but it really came out of an incredible struggle going on in Michigan, which is analogous, really, to what's happened in Wisconsin. Michigan passed a law which essentially said you could have a manager appointed by the executive to take over any town that met a certain number of criteria having to do with fiscal responsibility or whatever other kinds of things it said. And then once that manager took over, that was it. For the elected officials, that was it for the collective bargaining rights of the unions. They could set all those aside. So, Heidi, I don't know if you want to comment on that, but that's what this lawsuit is about.
Exactly. And one of the problems that it gives this individual the power to basically vitiate any legislation that's been passed to get away with the systems that have been in place.
That they tear up elections and that they can tear up union contracts.
It's amazing. And, of course, the town, I think, is Benton. Is that the name?
Benton Harbor. Yes. And
Benton
it's
Harbor.
Largely African-American.
I was going to say, this is a very poor town, right. And it's almost entirely African-American. It's a well-known town. And here you have the state of Michigan displacing its leadership.
And can I quote from Governor Rick Snyder, a Republican who was named as one of the defendant along with the state's treasurer in this lawsuit? He said, it's not an assault on collective bargaining the way I viewed it.
It's about helping communities and municipalities do the best they can to survive during difficult economic times. So they're going after the most vulnerable communities and essentially taking over, getting rid of...
And telling them we're doing it for your own good.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, Michael, we've seen over the years, especially since 2001, a lessening of the protections that had been set in place on FBI spying on individuals. And we recently had another setback.
We're so far away.
We might as well not have guidelines.
Right. I mean, I agree with that. You basically, under the guidelines, we're going to talk about a book that the center and Marjorie Ratner Kunstler and I wrote about dissent called Hell No, Your Right to Dissent in 21st Century America. But that book already had concluded that the FBI guidelines were completely meaningless. And you know that, Heidi, from your work at the National Lawyers Guild, that there was no the big issue is a criminal predicate. Can the FBI open an investigation of somebody and use intrusive surveillance techniques, such as putting an informant in your group? That's a big one.
Right.
The three of us get together to say, you know, let's start a little group against the war in Libya. A fourth person wants to join. Without any criminal predicate, any idea that we're going to do anything criminally, the fourth person could well be an FBI agent or informant.
Exactly.
That was already, at the time we wrote this book, which is just a few weeks ago, that was already there. Now, all of a sudden, there's a new set of internal guidelines for the FBI that say you can even do more. Instead of just an informant, you can use the informants continuously and over a period of time without opening an investigation. You can do trash covers, take the people's garbage and open investigations on all of those people. Basically, opening up all of dissent in America without any criminal predicate. And that's the new guidelines coming out of the Obama administration for the internal operation of the FBI. We talk about all this in the book Hell No, which again I recommend as an important book. As a result of what we've been discussing on these new guidelines for the FBI, Margaret Ratner Kunstler and I wrote an op-ed on it, talking about how this really opens up all of us to FBI spying and disruption. It's not just passive spying. You put informants into groups, you're talking about changing the directions those groups go. And
exactly.
How do you know
this? We know because the National Lawyers Guild was the subject of an FBI surveillance for many years. They rummaged through our members' trash, tapped our telephones. We had an infiltrator in our D.C. office. We sued the FBI with several local attorneys, Michael Krinsky, Jonathan Moore, and others, and we got them to admit that they had spied on us for years. But I think any group, as you said, any individual who dissents, who speaks out, is vulnerable now. Anyone who provides international solidarity work after humanitarian, the V. Holder decision, it's just the umbrella has widened and the protections are virtually gone.
That's right. I mean, now the call should be not just to not have these new guidelines go in. That's obvious. But there has to be a serious congressional hearing that looks at all the government spying in
the country. A new church commission, as it were.
New church commission. That's what brought us tighter guidelines in 1976. And since then, really, since 81, just a continuous deterioration.
You know, when the FBI files were liberated from their office in Media, Pennsylvania, which is right outside of Philadelphia, it was this great treasure trove and taught us a lot about what the FBI does. It does not catch people who steal cars and bring them across state lines. It principally does not go after people who take 17-year-old girls across state lines. The FBI, these media documents showed, is a political police force. It stands democracy on its head. You've got a government manipulating the population rather than responding to the population. And these guidelines should be destroyed. The FBI should go out and catch criminals and leave people who have ideas about what this country should be doing alone.
The guidelines shouldn't be called guidelines. They should be called, right, how to spy and end dissent in America.
Right.
And we call them a political police in the book because that's what they are.
Right.
They're a thought police and a political police. Anyway, the book is called Hell No, Your Right to Dissent in 21st Century America. It's by the Center for Constitutional Rights, Margaret Ratner Kunstler, and myself, Michael Ratner. And it includes a long essay on dissent, and then it includes what to do when the FBI knocks, which gives you your rights. The center has pamphlets, the guild has pamphlets, and that's included in this book because that's one of the most important, really, to me, one of the most important documents, whether you get it from the guild or the center.
Right.
Of, you know, as someone once said to me, talking to the FBI is like eating potato chips. Why is that?
As soon as you open your mouth, you can't stop talking.
Right. And you're an informant from then on.
It's called Hell No, Your Right to Dissent in 21st Century America. Vince Warren, the executive director of the CCR, wrote the preface. The New Press put it out. Summer reading, folks.
Michael, congratulations on your piece in last week's Progressive. It's called Anything Goes, the New FBI Guidelines, and you and Margaret Ratner Kunstler wrote this?
Yes, and as you suggested, Heidi, because it explains some of the newest issues going on with the FBI and the broad surveillance they can do of domestic dissent, you thought we ought to read it, and I think we'll do a little alliterative alternate reading.
Let me start. The FBI should not be given more power to spy on dissenters in America. In fact, it should not have that power at all.
Once upon a time, the FBI could investigate a person or organization only when the agency had reasonable suspicion of wrongdoing. This crucial requirement came about after the revelations of massive FBI abuse in the 1960s and early 1970s.
In 1976, Senator Frank Church of Idaho held hearings on FBI wrongdoing. The Church Committee's findings shed crucial light. In the wake of the hearings, the Attorney General of the United States drafted guidelines that mandated a criminal predicate before the FBI could launch an investigation. While often honored in the breach and watered down over the years, until 9/11, this requirement served as a crucial bulwark against FBI intrusion into our protected First Amendment activities.
Unfortunately, after the September 11th attacks, first under Attorney General John Ashcroft and then under Attorney General Michael Mukasey, the requirement of a criminal predicate was removed. As a result, the FBI and other anti-terrorist agencies spied on many forms of legitimate protest and dissent. For example, pacifist groups such as the Thomas Merton Center and Catholic Worker were investigated under the rubric of domestic terrorism.
Protests have been a special target. For instance, 15 months prior to the 2008 Republican National Convention in St. Paul, Minneapolis, a specially created FBI intelligence center began to spy on and place informants in groups it suspected were going to participate in demonstrations. President Obama campaigned on protecting our civil liberties, so you might have expected his Attorney General, Eric Holder, to provide people with greater protections from FBI snoops. But he has not, and it is about to get even worse.
The new Domestic Investigations and Operations Guide will empower the FBI to dispatch surveillance teams, to follow targets, to dig through trash, to search commercial databases, and to expand the use of informants to infiltrate a wide range of organizations.
If you are part of a group that disagrees with government policy in Iraq or Afghanistan, or that dislikes nuclear energy, the next time you throw out your trash, an FBI agent may be examining it a few hours later, from what you eat, to what you buy, to what you read and think.
The next time you attend a meeting to fight for better schools, protest drug testing on animals, or criticize almost any aspects of government policy, the person next to you may be an informant, recording everything you say. Or perhaps the informant will participate in the meeting, steering the organization's activities in ways the government wishes.
It is now almost 10 years after 9/11, the event that frightened many into giving the FBI broad spying authority. Authority that now threatens the very essence of democracy. Piece by piece, the constitutional protections for dissent are disappearing.
It's time for new congressional hearings, similar to the Church Committee's, on FBI spying. We must protest the new expanded powers about to be bestowed on the FBI and follow that with a demand to Attorney General Holder for new guidelines ensuring that dissent and protest will be off limits to the FBI.
Michael Ratner is the president, and Margaret Ratner Kunstler is former education director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. They are the co-authors of Hell No, Your Right to Dissent in the 21st Century.
In a significant protest to stop mountaintop removal mining, hundreds of activists finished a five-day, 50-mile march earlier this month from Marmot, West Virginia, to Blair Mountain, West Virginia. The massive but under-publicized march also marked the historic Battle of Blair Mountain, the largest armed conflict in U.S. labor history. In 1921, thousands of miners near the area marched in an effort to organize non-union local coal mines. This year's demonstration ended in a rally of speakers, musicians, celebrities, union workers, and picketing at the top of Blair Mountain. The demonstration drew attention to the demand of sustainable job creation in all Appalachian communities, the abolition of mountaintop removal, the strengthening of labor rights, and efforts to preserve Blair Mountain. As many listeners know, mountaintop removal utterly destroys the mountain and the surrounding environment. We're joined by National Lawyers Guild attorney Dan Greger, who was at the march.
Dan, welcome back from this momentous and historic protest at Blair Mountain.
Thank you.
Tell us briefly, what were people protesting, and also what was the significance of the location?
The march on Blair Mountain was about mountaintop removal coal mining, which most of your listeners will probably know about, but it's a really horrific form of strip mining where you blow the top of a mountain off, strip out the coal, and then put some fill dirt back on top and put some monocrop species on it and call it good. And it poisons communities and individuals and destroys home sites where families have lived for literally hundreds of years. The march itself was about 50 miles from Marmette, which is just south of Charleston, to the town of Blair. And then the day of action was a march from the town of Blair up Blair Mountain. The significance of the location is in 1921, in September, the largest armed labor uprising in American history took place there. Somewhere between 10,000 and 15,000 coal miners took up arms against oppressive working conditions, company towns, all those things we've all heard about. So it was to call for an end to mountaintop removal coal mining and also using the Battle of Blair Mountain in 1921 as kind of a historical backdrop and setting for that.
Dan, I understand that because of its historical significance, Blair Mountain was actually listed for a brief period of time in 2009 on the National Register of Historic Places, but coal companies got it delisted.
Oh, no.
And
yes.
Activists are now trying to get it back on that protected list to keep it from being destroyed by mining. Is that part of the action?
That wasn't part of this specific action. I think that is part and parcel of what we're dealing with there. And it is not an exaggeration to say that big coal owned southern West Virginia. Logan County, where that is, Boone County, where we walked through, these are places where big coal has more or less owned the politics, the citizenry, the economy for, you know, almost a century. And the congressional delegation is very sympathetic to coal jobs, what they perceive as coal jobs. So it is definitely one of the struggles that we're facing there. The March on Blair Mountain, you know, that's one of kind of the context, one of the back pieces, but not one of the things that we were working on this march.
And what were the numbers of people who showed up? I hear it was between 500 and 1,000.
Yeah. I mean, what we had marching the 50 miles during the week was between 200 and 250 at any given time. Then for the encampment and rally and day of action in the town of Blair, estimates were a little over 1,000, somewhere between 1,000 and 1,050 were a couple of counts. Walking up Blair Mountain, we had a National Lawyers Guild Legal Observer do a count at my request. We had an independent reporter do a count, came up with about 775 people marching up Blair Mountain. And then of those, about 150 of us went up onto a permitted mine site on Blair Mountain where the historic battlefield was.
It's so great that you did that. I really wish I could have been with you.
Yeah.
So talk to us about what it was like when you were marching up the mountain.
It was intense. And it's something that I appreciate a lot of attorneys don't get the opportunity to do or don't by disposition desire to do. But putting myself in the way that I can best do legal support and as one of the or logistics organizers for the event, best do organizing support, it meant putting myself in a position where I was knowingly arrestable. It was alternately exciting and freeing and terrifying. It's not obviously something that we as attorneys, those of us who are attorneys, are accustomed to doing. It's certainly not the way we're trained to be lawyers. It's a very activist lawyer, resistance lawyer kind of approach to it, and, you know, exciting and freeing and scary.
What was the response, Dan, of the local residents?
You know, pretty mixed. We certainly had very strong support from a number of locals who have seen their communities decimated by mountaintop removal mining and by its effects. And then there are certainly locals who don't understand that this doesn't mean more jobs or that it means a fraction of the jobs that once existed for unionized coal miners. Very roughly, I might call it 50-50. We had extraordinary support from some folks and a great deal of pushback or resistance from other folks.
And how did that translate in terms of law enforcement presence?
The law enforcement presence was really all over the board. We had pretty extraordinary assistance and cooperation from certain law enforcement agencies, and I could give shout-outs if y'all wanted. We also, in Boone County, West Virginia, which, you know, is arguably one of the two or three or four most pro-coal counties on Earth, the Boone County Sheriff's Department was somewhat less than helpful. For the most part, the West Virginia State Police were professional and did their jobs carefully. We definitely did not see police misconduct, police brutality like you might see in some mass protest situations. So it was varied. By the end of it, by the end of 6 days, the West Virginia State Police were somewhat tired of us. On the other end of the spectrum, the Marmette Police Department was fantastic and was helpful and supportive. And we're talking a police department of, I believe, five people there, but small town West Virginia police, and they were very, very helpful.
Dan, it just seems to me extraordinary that these companies can destroy the landscape. They get away with it. They keep getting away with it. You don't even hear any criticism from the White House on it. They just allow them to keep doing it. And my question to you is, what kind of overall strategy do you have that we and our listeners can get down with and try to do something to help in this?
Well, I'm just one organizer and one attorney and one piece of a much larger movement. I mean, the broader strategy is calling for an absolute end to mountaintop removal coal mining, transitioning to a clean economy with wind, with solar. I mean, one of the specific things that we'd like to see happen on Coal River Mountain is see that turned into a wind farm rather than a mountaintop removal site. In terms of political will, it's real tough, and I think that there have been gains by a lot of the groups that are working on it in the last few years, but we need to be pressuring the EPA, pressuring the White House to really just stop this. One of the reasons why you don't see a lot of mountaintops being blown up in Tennessee, for example, is that the congressional delegation there has been resistant to it. In West Virginia, historically, it hasn't. And I think it's worth pointing out here, calling the White House to task since you bring it up, that mountaintop removal coal mining produces very pure, very high anthracite coal. This is a significant part of the Obama administration's so-called clean coal strategy.
Yeah.
So one of the organizing principles is trying to get people to understand that there's no such thing as clean coal. Coal is filthy, you know, no matter how you mine it, how you produce it.
Dan, were there arrests during these 5 days?
Well, 6 days, and the answer is that we had one arrest, and that was a person who I think was very conscious and voluntary about it. Walking up Blair Mountain, there was a trespass warning given by a private security guard. It was our interpretation and position that person wasn't necessarily empowered to give the trespass warning. We kept walking, got up to the top. West Virginia State Police made it very clear that we needed to turn around and leave. And we'd gotten, you know, almost 2 hours up the mountain. It was a good hour and a half to 2 hour walk. Everybody did indeed do that. We started turning around and walking back down. There were signs that were being placed as sort of a memoriam to the Battle of Blair Mountain. One gentleman placed his sign. He was instructed by police to remove it. He declined and kept walking. They warned him again at least once, possibly twice, and then they did indeed arrest him. But, you know, given that, it's, to my mind, pretty impressive that we got to do this entire action, a week of walking on roads and the day of action and the memorialization on the battlefield with one arrest, and that was where I think he consciously chose it and wanted it. He was released that same day within a few hours on his own recognizance.
You've been working over the past year on assisting protesters at mountaintop removal sites?
It's been about a year.
So how many times have you been there?
I've been to West Virginia 9 or 10 times, usually for a week to 2 weeks at a time. And I'm extraordinarily lucky and privileged that a great deal of my practice is resistance law and is assisting resistance communities. So I've been able to make this a kind of significant focus of my life as an attorney and as an organizer.
And speaking of attorneys, are there any lawsuits pending against coal companies?
Well, the civil side litigation, I'm honestly not super familiar with, and there are attorneys, including National Lawyers Guild attorneys, who are much more familiar with it than I am. There are largely responsive or reactive suits out there where big coal, Massey, which is recently, you know, a monster by a different name called Alpha, has filed slap suits, strategic lawsuits against public participation. And so some of the civil side litigation that I, again, am not involved with is defending those slap suits, is responding to them. We have certainly talked about, and attorneys and legal workers from the Center for Constitutional Rights have been involved in discussions about possible legal strategies for affirmative civil suits. That is just not my area of knowledge. I really mostly do the protest, defense, resistance law and criminal defense side.
Attorney Dan Greger from the National Lawyers Guild, is there a website our listeners can go to stay in tune and get involved with this?
Yes, actually, I'll give you a couple. One would be ilovemountains.org, just spelled out, ilovemountains.org.
Not L-U-V, I assume.
No, L-O-V-E. Another would be, there's a coalition of groups called the Alliance for Appalachia, and that is allianceforappalachia.org. And there are, I believe, 14 groups within that. All of their key point people are directly involved in the fight against mountaintop removal mining. So that would be a good place to get kind of a broad umbrella information. What is mountaintop removal coal mining? What the struggles are against it, and how people can plug in. And I mean, I guess the only thing I would add is absolutely, we can always use more people, more activists, more attorneys, more folks willing to fight against this. And on any of those websites, you'll be able to find ways to plug in if you're interested.
Dan, right. Are there any actions coming up in the foreseeable future that we should know about there?
There are individual groups and affinity groups that may be planning things that I'm not really party to in terms of big actions, big things like the March on Blair Mountain, not on the near radar. And that was definitely a question that we were getting at the end there, is this is so fantastic, so wonderful, when are you going to do it again? No major events are planned. There are individual groups who may well be planning individual actions or events, but in terms of the mass scale event like the March on Blair Mountain, we don't currently have those on the radar. It was about 6 months of organizing effort that went into putting on the March on Blair Mountain, and it's just a massive task for mostly all volunteer folks.
Well, we'd all like to say congratulations for a job well done on one of the more pressing environmental and human rights issues, really, of our time.
And I'd like to pass on that congratulations to the other 40 or 50 core organizers who were involved in putting this on, and I'll just take a tiny little piece of it.
Definitely. Dan, thanks so much.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to talk to you.
Cheers.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Now, if you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, won't be long. You get shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay, take a kid to the seashore. It ain't quite this simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Cause if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be a-waiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be buried, gone to heaven. St. Peter will be the straw boss then. Now you know you're underpaid, but the boss says you ain't. He speeds up the work till you're about to faint. You may be down and out, but you ain't beaten. You can pass out a leaflet and call a meeting, talk it over, speak your mind, decide to do something about it. Of course, the boss may persuade some poor damn fool to go to your meeting and act like a stool, but you can always tell a stool, though, well, that's a fact. He's got a yaller streaker running down his back. He doesn't have to stool. He'll always get along on what he takes out of blind men's cups. You got a union now and you're sitting pretty. Put some of the boys on the steering committee. The boss won't listen when one guy squawks, but he's got to listen when the union talks. He'd better be mighty lonely. Everybody decide to walk out on him. Suppose they're working you so hard it's just outrageous, and they're paying you all starvation wages. You go to the boss and the boss would yell, before I raise your pay, I'd see you all in hell. Well, he's puffing a big cigar, feeling mighty slick, cause he thinks he's got your union licked. Well, he looks out the window and what does he see but 1,000 pickets, and they all agree he's a bastard. Unfair! Slave driver. Bet he beats his wife. Now, boys, you come to the hardest time. The boss will try to bust your picket line. He'll call out the police, the National Guard. They'll tell you it's a crime to have a union card. They'll raid your meeting. They'll hit you on the head. They'll call every one of you a damn red unpatriotic. Japanese spies. Sabotaging national defense.
A wave of civil resistance continues throughout the country of Tunisia, sparked by high unemployment, food inflation, corruption, and lack of democratic rights. During the country's civil unrest, President Ben Ali was ousted as president, fleeing to Saudi Arabia after 23 years in power. Now human rights violations are being investigated. A group of lawyers for the United States, the United Kingdom, and Turkey have been investigating the U.S. and European complicity in human rights abuses committed by the Ben Ali regime. The group has recently issued a warning that the U.S. and other Western governments must respect Tunisian sovereignty and not interfere in that country's path to democracy. Atlanta attorney and National Lawyers Guild Executive Vice President Azadeh Shashahani was a member of the delegation and is on a speaking tour of the United States. To discuss more about the investigation, Azadeh joins us today.
Azadeh, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, we have in our hands the new report, Promises and Challenges, the Tunisian Revolution of 2010 to 2011, that is the result of your March 2011 delegation of attorneys from the National Lawyers Guild, the Haldane Society of Socialist Lawyers, and Maslender from Turkey. Tell us a bit first about how the delegation came to be and what your goals were.
The delegation, you know, was put together, as you mentioned, you know, from by attorneys and academics from the three countries, as well as a Tunisian attorney currently in the UK who hadn't been back for 20 years because of political persecution. And we went to Tunisia at the invitation of the Tunisian Bar Association. And I should mention that, you know, the Tunisian diaspora in the UK in particular has expressed, you know, great interest for, you know, delegation of international lawyers to go to Tunisia while the revolution was happening and the crackdown and, you know, the abuse that we were hearing about. And before we knew it, you know, the government had been toppled. And yet there was still, you know, great interest in having a delegation come and as a means of support and solidarity with the people, but also to look into, you know, possible support rendered to the Ben Ali regime by the Western governments, including the U.S.
And you met, I understand, with several non-governmental organizations, labor leaders, former political prisoners and torture victims, judges, lawyers. How were those meetings in general in terms of the information that you were able to get?
Yes, you know, we were able to meet with, you know, a range of different people, and many of whom had been instrumental in, you know, in the revolution and, you know, had been key players. And we also met with bloggers, lawyers, and a former judge. They were very productive meetings. You know, we learned a lot about, you know, both the abuses of the Ben Ali regime and how that had impacted the community, and I had tore at, you know, the fabrics of the society and the perception of the Tunisian people about the role and the support of Western governments, particularly the U.S., for the abuses of the Ben Ali regime.
And can you talk a bit how some of those responses and their thoughts, particularly as it relates to our so-called war on terror, how has that affected them?
The Tunisian government passed this law, the 2003 Anti-Terror Act. It's not very clear to us still, you know, the particular role of the U.S. in creation of that particular legislation, but what was clear was that the U.S. government, you know, the State Department was very supportive of that legislation and, you know, lauded it, you know, when, you know, when it came about. And obviously, you know, the U.S. government was lending economic and diplomatic and military support to the Ben Ali regime, despite being very much aware of the abuses of the Ben Ali regime. I mean, if you go back and look at the State Department reports from this period, you know, the annual human rights reports, you can see that, you know, the human rights violations are actually documented in those reports. So it's not like, you know, the U.S. government didn't know what was happening in those jails, you know, the lack of due process, you know, the massive arrest, detention of political activists, and particularly Islamists. You know, after the legislation went into effect, a lot of people were picked up for the mere suspicion of really being a Muslim, you know, being a devout, you know, person, and, you know, perhaps engaging in, you know, religious discussions with your friends. You know, a lot of youth were, you know, arrested and then, you know, subjected to torture. I mean, torture really seemed to be very systematic. You know, it was, you know, really the first step after you're arrested and you're detained and you're tortured and, you know, confession is obtained and, you know, you're put through this really kangaroo, you know, trial. And then the judges were, you know, very much pressured by the executive and lacked very, you know, any real independence. Then you'd be tried and convicted and, you know, sent to prison. And it led to families being separated, especially the youth. I should mention that, you know, some people actually died under torture. You know, one of the most moving meetings, gatherings that we went to during our delegation was on the second full day of the delegation. We were really fortunate to be invited to this really inspiring gathering of thousands of former political prisoners, but also families of the disappeared and people who had, you know, perished under torture. You know, families and, you know, moms and dads, you know, got up and spoke. And there was this one mom saying that, you know, his son had disappeared. And then when he went to the police station and he said, you know, my son is not a terrorist. He doesn't have anything to do with any terror organization. And then, you know, they have said to him, but he does pray, doesn't he? And so that seemed to be, you know, the sole basis for, you know, having picked up his son. So, I mean, stories like that just really abounded, and it was really tragic to see that.
Azadeh, are there any concrete figures about the number of disappeared?
The figures coming from the Justice Ministry are different from the figures that more independent figures, you know, including a journalist in our, who, you know, facilitated our delegation. There is some discrepancy in regards to that. But the UN Special Rapporteur on Protecting Human Rights While Combating Terrorism actually paid a visit to Tunisia and came out with a report in December 2010. And, you know, one figure that he had included in the report was that, you know, the rate of, you know, arrest of people was one per day under the auspices of the 2003 Anti-Terror Act.
Did people that you met with give you specific recommendations about U.S. involvement?
Definitely. I mean, people would very much like to be left alone, you know. Actually, while we were there, Secretary of State Clinton was visiting, and, you know, we happened to be in a hotel facing the, you know, Ministry of Interior, where actually, you know, a lot of the torture had been happening previously, and it was, you know, a really key site for a lot of the demonstrations happening, you know, during the revolution. And, you know, even still, pretty much every day there was some kind of gathering, protest, demonstration happening there. And so, you know, when Clinton was there, we witnessed, you know, this massive protest in opposition to the U.S. government policies and asking Clinton to get out. So that was, you know, really the big message coming from people that we met with, from, you know, political party leaders to students to bloggers to, you know, labor union leaders. You know, people would want to have sovereignty and they would want to have control over their own future. And I think that is, you know, basic right of any people to, you know, have that type of control over their own future.
I've been you know, obviously very excited by what's called the Arab Spring, which, you know, in Tunisia and Egypt and across the whole Middle East. And then I saw this picture of Obama at the G8 conference sitting on a stool saying, well, the U.S. has increased its aid to Egypt from $2 to $3 billion. We're getting $4 billion from the IMF for Egypt. We just got $4 billion from Saudi Arabia for Egypt because Egypt was $20 billion in debt. And I presume we can tell some of the same story about Tunisia, that we're in a world financial system where to survive, it's going to probably need IMF. I don't know if it'll need Saudi Arabia. It's going to need the United States. And so while we can talk about independence and people in the streets and democracy, in the end, don't we have a real problem with the Arab Spring in that it's put into a context of an utterly capitalist world where the IMF, Saudi Arabia, and the United States are very dominant? And isn't that going to really blunt what happens in Tunisia? Yeah, we may get some cosmetic stuff around torture and some other things, but are we really ever going to get a country that has its own sovereignty?
These were the questions that actually, you know, we had, you know, among ourselves, you know, our delegation. And it didn't seem to us that, you know, the folks that we had met with, you know, including some of the leaders of NATO, the Islamic Party, it wasn't clear to us that those types of, you know, calculations about, you know, the extent of sovereignty that the country can have, if it is still going to buy into the whole, one could argue, as you were saying, you know, there might not actually be an actual choice not to, you know, opt into that whole system. And, you know, how much sovereignty the country would have. It really remains to be seen.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, it's significant what's happened in that, you know, the power of the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and others were challenged in the Middle East. But it's within a certain limits as the world is now established. I mean, you know, there's not even a Soviet Union to go to for other aid. It's a pretty tough structure out there for democratic change that's more than superficial. And so it's not that we shouldn't continue to fight the way this report talks about, and, you know, particularly on the human rights issues as well as on what people in Tunisia want. It's just that these are issues that have to be explored deeply because Tunisia is going to be sitting there and saying, well, you haven't had any tourism for a while. And that's, you know, with Egypt, it was 30% of its economy, and therefore the place became broke. Now they're stuck. So it's a rough position.
Right.
Azadeh, let's briefly go over the recommendations listed in the report. It starts with the U.S. and other Western governments must respect Tunisian sovereignty and end Western interference in Tunisian affairs. You also call for an end to U.S. and Western military aid to the Tunisian government. Any other specific ones you'd like to mention?
You know, in terms of assistance to political parties, we call for, you know, an end to that. Again, you know, we believe that it really should be up to the Tunisian people to determine their own political future, as well as, you know, supporting and complying with Tunisian requests regarding legal and financial accountability for Ben Ali and his family, aiding the request for extradition of Ben Ali and his family. And, you know, they're currently in Saudi Arabia, and, you know, it's not at all clear to us that there is any intention or plans for, you know, his extradition. But, you know, in any case,
that could be a good joke. Saudi Arabia is going to extradite Ben Ali. That'll be pretty amazing. There's no plans is one thing. Come on, they're all there, right? Idi Amin went to Saudi Arabia, as I recall, from Central Africa. You know, after slaughtering tens of thousands, you know, that's where they're going to be. We're not going to see Saudi Arabia extradite anybody. You know,
unless there's a revolution in Saudi Arabia.
Right, which is what our best hope would be. That would be the greatest thing that could happen. But, well, the revolution will start with women driving.
They're pushing for that, so it might happen sooner than you think.
Please, one of my friends is a woman pilot for Emirate Air, and she used to fly with a woman from Saudi Arabia, a woman pilot from Saudi Arabia. Woman would fly her jet all over, and then these big jets all over the world. She'd land the plane in Saudi Arabia. She'd walk out of the plane, and a man had to pick her up in a car because she wasn't allowed to drive. Nice.
Right.
Tells it all. I didn't mean to interrupt on your recommendations, but
just a general recognition and acknowledgement that, you know, the U.S. and Western governments' activities in pursuing the war on terror resulted in repression of people and organizations for their political and religious beliefs. So really this whole, you know, war on terror paradigm, provided the Ben Ali regime with an, enabling mechanism and justification to continue his repressive tactics. And we also, ask that any such, for the U.S. government to, initiate an inquiry into this, the extent to which, this paradigm, led to abuses, and for, the inquiry to be broad and transparent. We also ask for compensation to Tunisian Guantanamo detainees. We actually did have the opportunity to meet with one, formerly detained, person formerly detained in Guantanamo, and he was still very much suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and a range of other, ailments. The least the U.S. government could do is to, take care of those, expenses related to, the inhumane treatment that he suffered at Guantanamo.
Azadeh, how are you distributing the report?
It is up on the Guild website, and has been sent to the media contacts. We have written an opinion piece that should be up, pretty soon, and we're sending the report to other human rights organizations that have, expressed an interest, have been doing research on Tunisia, including a Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. And we are, we hope to send it to people in the administration, allies in Congress, as well as the report is in the process of being translated to Arabic. And we very much hope that we can get it to the Tunisian people as soon as possible. I mean, I should mention that there was great interest, when we were there, on the part of the press and the general public, about the delegation, and we very much owe it to the people that, we met with to have this product, in their hands.
Well, Azadeh, we really thank you for not only going on the delegation, being part of the report preparation, but coming once again to join us on Law and Disorder. And we look forward to continuing dialogues about these issues in the future.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you, Azadeh. I mean, it was courageous, I think, for you and the Guild and others to do it. And I really admire it. I mean, we read about what's going on in the Middle East a bit. But to actually go into it is quite important, particularly North Africa right now.
Thank you so much.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Thank you.